Hi, this is Tessa from Don't Forget the Bubbles. This talk was recorded live at DFTB 18. Enjoy the show.
So I've called my talk, It's My Party and I'll Cry If I Want To. And I've called it that because, like David, I want to talk about normalising infant crying. And I want to emphasise that it is, in fact, a bit of a party. At the end of this talk, what I'd like to have achieved is that you have reframed your approach to this, and so that next time you see the triage that says infant crying, parents concerned, blah, 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 you don't put your head down and pretend that you have 50,000 jobs to do and hope that your colleague picks up the next patient. In fact, that you take this patient and you go forth and you conquer and you change this family's world. If you take anything from this talk, what I want you to talk is that your job as a healthcare professional is actually to identify the sick and to calm the panic. And through your experience, your background, the examination, the history taking, and the backing of science, lead the family on the journey to reassurance so that they can understand that their baby is a normal baby and that this isn't this is a normal developmental phenomenon in infants. When I was thinking about how to structure this talk, I was thinking about, well, the three things that are really involved. There's the infant, of course, the troublemaker. There's the caregivers that, to us, are the real troublemakers. And then there's the crying. Now, if any of the infants in the audience would like to provide some soundtrack, by all means, feel welcome. And then that would, in fact, help us to understand how troublesome this can be for some families. So let's start with the story. It's 10:15 on a Monday evening. Now, I don't know about you, but Monday nights in our emergency department are generally horrible. I don't know what it is about Monday. Well, in fact, you do know what it is about Monday, but they're generally horrible. It's 10:15, you haven't had any dinner, and you are counting down the seconds till the night team arrive. You're asked by a very nice nurse to see a little baby who's been in the waiting room for 2 hours. He was given a Cat 4. He's been crying and his parents are convinced that he has something wrong, that he's got abdominal pain. You notice on the triage that he's 5.8 and he's had his 6 kilos and he's had his 6 weeks immunisation and he's on omeprazole. You also notice on the triage note that they say he is asleep and settled at triage. So off you go. You think, right, taking it for the team, okay, knowing that you've kissed goodbye to the next hour of your life and you're going to miss handover. So you walk in there, washing your hands, introduce yourself to the family. You see that Dad's holding baby Oliver, who's a very chubby, vigorously crying individual, and that Dad is, trying to calm him down. Mum is quietly crying in the corner. Grandmother stands up immediately and meets you with mild hostility and says that they are not leaving until you find what is wrong with the baby. So we all know this is the heart sink consultation, okay? The heart sink. But what I think it's important is this is the moment of truth for this family. This is where this family's story starts. You need to avoid the bias. You need to realise that they haven't come here on a Monday night at 10 or 8:15 they actually came in because they want to and they've got nothing else to do and the bachelor's finished. They came in because they have genuine concern and worry for their child. You need to avoid your pre-consultation bias because you go in there thinking there will be nothing wrong with this baby, there's nothing wrong with the family, you might miss something. This first interaction is critical and, in fact, the way I like to think about it is this may well be this child and this family's first presentation ever to an emergency department. So it's the beginning of their ED story. And every subsequent presentation may well be flavoured and changed by the way you approach this. And if you think that grandma's crossed now, you wait what she'll be like in 3 weeks' time when you've palmed them off. So raise up your heart, pick up the baby, and off you go. So when I was looking at crying is a very interesting phenomenon. I must admit that I went fairly far down the linguistic rabbit hole of what crying is all about. But crying is basically the only noise that babies can make. Thank you. And crying is the word in English, is the same word, exactly the same word that we use for any form of external vocalisation of stress, be it from incredible psychological or emotional pain or even joy. There are languages, however, where the word crying, the noise that baby makes, is not given a literal translation of crying. So there's some languages where it's referred to as cooing or calling or meowing or other animal noises. And when you look at this, you wonder, is there any wonder that we automatically attribute pain and distress to babies who cry when we have a sort of a linguistic bias to do so? Crying is a very strong and powerful signal. All babies cry, all people cry. And as I say to parents, babies cry because they can't use their words, they can't politely ask or impatiently demand. Crying is a very effective tool. It's loud. So the average infant cry has been measured at between 99 and 122 decibels. Now, when you consider that the pain threshold, which is a jet plane taking off, is 122 decibels, a rock concert is 120 decibels, and that the loudest human noise made is 129 decibels, you've got to remember that's a pretty loud and pretty noxious stimulus. Is it any wonder then that persistent crying is one of the most predictive factors for abusive head traumas in children? Crying is automatically stimulates various parts of our brain and our endocrine and neurophysiological systems to call us into action. There was a recent study published, and I read it in The Guardian, I'll be honest, in Oxford, where they looked at 100 non-parents, and they played the arcade game Whack-A-Mole. I don't know if you know the game Whack-A-Mole. It's like you get a big rubber hammer and you whack moles as they jump up through their holes. And they put the subjects through a variety of noxious stimuli, including listening to a baby cry. And the performance was most improved from any of the stimuli after listening to the baby cry. And so they have postulated that crying increases our reflex time, increases our strength of hitting. So it's a very strong stimulus for change. Crying occurs all over the world. All babies cry. The little babies strapped to their mum's backs in China and to the Eskimo babies wrapped up in there. Every baby has been documented to cry. And in fact, it's not only human babies that cry. Other mammalian species and birds. Have you ever heard a baby bird crying? They're really noisy. So all animals as infants will cry as a way of getting attention. So across all cultures, this peak of crying is the time that David described between 2 and 12 weeks. And it also corresponds with the time where they turn from a red, angry little nothing to a smiling, beautiful little four-month-old. And that's a huge transition. That's a lot of skill for them to learn. So crying corresponds with the time when they have this huge leap in their neurodevelopmental development. And I often like to say to parents, they often get unsettled before they learn a new skill. You have to give them some positive, and it doesn't matter. You can say, sometimes people think that crying babies are going to be really smart. You have to give them something. So all babies will cry between 2 and 12 weeks. About 20% of babies are defined as being excessive cries. So, by definition, if it's 20%, it's probably normal, isn't it? So excessive crying is described as being for more than 3 hours a day, for more than 3 days a week, for more than three consecutive weeks. And that's about 10 to 20. Now, there are some risk factors for the report of excessive crying. The most positive predictive risk factor for the report of infant crying is actually sitting in this room. It's mothers of advanced maternal age with high levels of education and breastfeeding. Okay, that's for the people who report high infant crying. There's also some reports, there's also some studies that look at the use of antidepressant medication pre and during pregnancy in terms of increased of reported crying, social disharmony and familial breakdown are two of the other big things. So this brings us to the colic conundrum, and I like to call it this because is colic really a thing? So in 1954, the American paediatrician, Dr. Wessel, just looked at these babies, and I've read his original paper, and it's quite interesting, and we can no longer do studies like he did them. We can't give barbiturates left, right, and centre to everybody, although tempting as it might be. And he described this syndrome of paroxysmal fussing in otherwise well babies as defined by the rule of three, and he's the gentleman that's responsible for this rule of three. He observed these babies, and over many weeks and months, and in fact years, and came up to describe that they all looked the same, that they were crying, red faced, drawing their legs up, appeared to be bloated in their belly and passed a lot of wind, essentially, and that it was very marked to diurnal rhythm, so that they were much worse in the afternoons than they were in the morning. And it's still something that we don't really understand, and we don't understand why it happens, but it is normal. Now, I call it the colic conundrum because I'm not sure it's helpful to label it as colic. People look at it as a label, and then and because of the word colic, and we use colic for renal colic and colicky abdominal pain, then I think it automatically gives it a pathological meaning. It automatically associates it with the gut, and we don't even know that it's anything to do with gut. Babies draw their legs up because they can't do anything else. They've been curled up for months and months inside their belly, and that's what they do. So if it is, if you are to give somebody a diagnosis of colic, well, it might help some people, but it does need to be associated with a very good explanation that, in fact, colic is a normal phenomenon. So how do we know which babies are going to cry? So there's this study that they looked at in, this is a German study, I think, this one. And they looked at 1,865 babies. And of those babies, this is a retrospective study, they were ringing them for all sorts of things and they got lots of information from them. But of those 1,865 babies, 83% of them were identified as being pretty happy babies, that they did not fulfill criteria for excessive crying, and so they were happy babies. About 17% of those babies, so about 304 of those babies, were identified as being irritable or crying babies. About 60% of those babies stopped crying by 3 months. So by 12 to 14 weeks, those babies were happy, smiley babies. About another 20% of those babies continued to cry and be fussy and hard work until they were about 6 months, and then they turned into happy babies. And about 47, which is 2.5% of the total cohort, continued to be grumpy babies, and that after they had persistent crying that lasted for more than 6 months. Now, these babies were found, follow up at 1 year and at 3 years, to be 9 times more likely to have coexistent feeding and sleeping issues at 1 and year 3, 4. But what we can say to the one patient that we're seeing is that you're much more likely to be in the 83% of these babies, and that, you know, the vast majority of these babies will stop crying. So how do we work it out? Well, like most things, it's all in the story. Now, I'm a big believer, and I've worked with quite a few people in this room, and they know I like to carry a baby around. I'm a big believer in holding the infant as you do the consultation. I think it has many positive fallouts from that. I think the parent then can relax, they can listen, they don't have the screaming baby in their ear. I like to think of myself as a bit of a baby whisperer. But I also do think that you get a really good feel of the tone, the demeanour, the consolability of the infant. And I think it's a really good thing to do. It's a bit hard now, we're all electronic and I'm not very good at typing and balancing a baby on my hip. But when you're holding the baby and you're talking, it's really important to take an extremely detailed history. It's almost like a forensic type history where how, who, when, where, what. So you need to know everything about the feeding, what type of feeding they're doing, what's the weight gain doing, when's the crying, what have they done about it, who have they seen, you know, who lives next door, etc. You need to make an extremely detailed history because that's where you'll pick the wheat from the chaff. That's where you'll find the kids that follow the red flags that David talked about. And luckily, our red flags match. When you need to examine the baby, so it's really important once you've taken a really thorough history that you do a full examination. Now, plenty of these babies have been to their GPs before, and I don't have a hat on, but if I would take it off many times to all the GPs because I do not know how they ever do anything in 10 minutes. Because I know, as I've said, I've already kissed goodbye to an hour of my life to deal with this. But it's really important that you take a really thorough examination, and that includes a full set of observations, including blood pressure. So it might be the only time that the infant has a blood pressure. And if you're going to find something, you might find it there. And we have machines, and machines are really reassuring for people. Like you put a SATS probe on, that's really reassuring. I love saying that number 99, that's the best you can get. That's the best I've seen all day. But, you know, very reassuring. Okay. So when you do the examination, it needs to be systematic. You need to expose the baby. You can't, you know, maybe not all at once because then they'll just scream, but you need to see every little bit of skin. So looking from the top to the toe, and there is the It Cries mnemonic has been used before, so to not forget anything, thinking that we're looking here for any you know, red flags, any reasons why these babies are crying. Things like a tourniquet, a hair tourniquet. I don't know if you've ever seen a hair tourniquet on an infant before. I certainly have. You know, seeing as we're all friends here, I can share a story. I once in Birmingham in England had an infant that was just crying, and had a high-pitched, you know, just a proper pain cry. So I thought, oh, well, and I was an SHO, very keen to do everything. Did the bloods, did the urine, did the this. I thought, I'm going to have to lumbar puncture this baby. Great. So did this lumbar puncture, cleaned the baby's back, did everything, did the lumbar puncture, got a bit of betadine on his socks, pulled his socks off, saw one of mum's hairs wrapped around his toes. So I was very confidently able to go into mum and say, great news, your baby doesn't have meningitis, and they've stopped crying. But if you don't look, you don't miss. And have I ever not taken both socks off again? No. Okay. Same with fluorescein. You do feel pretty stupid when the radiographer tells you that baby's eye seems to be watering as you've sent them around for their ultrasound for their intussusception. Look in their mouth for thrush and for burns. So bottles, you know, hot bottles can cause burns. And I always put this, I talk about this because this is something I once saw a baby that everybody had commented how beautifully big this baby's eyes were. And in fact, this baby had bilateral congenital glaucoma. So just be aware of these little things that can hide. Things to watch out for. Well, luckily, as I said, my red flags match up very nicely with David's. You'd think we were both paediatricians. It's always important to take the history. Is this an acute onset? So did this happen today? Is this a new thing? If you have a very reassuring history that this baby is happy in the mornings and grumpy in the evenings and has been like that for the last 3 weeks, that's very reassuring. But if it's in an acute onset that yesterday they were happy and this morning they're happy and bang, now they're not happy, that's a different story. Are they consolable? So can you console them within the emergency department? Has there been an acute change in demeanour? So were they smiling and has mum not had a smile today? Is there something different about the baby? Obviously this fever, obviously the presence of bruising and weight loss. Weight loss is always a red flag in infants. And if you have identified any immediate safety concerns for this family, that's also a red flag. So what do we need to do? Well, luckily people have looked at this. And so do we need to do any tests? Well, no is the answer, essentially. So in 2009, Dr. Friedman and his friends had a look at 237 crying babies, and they found in their nose about 5% of those had a serious underlying cause, and that was, the vast majority of them, that was urinary tract infection, and a few others that was things like scratches, anal fissures, and they caused those serious underlying cause. Of all of those that had a serious underlying cause, two of them, so it's 0.8 of the total, had the cause found with only the test. So a normal examination, normal history, and the test added the money shot. So that was 0.8% of the total cohort, and they were both urinary tract infections in babies under 4 months old. So the bottom line for this is that in a thriving, well-appearing infant, urine test isn't the only test that you may be required. Now, I put that in carefully because we all know it can be difficult to get a good, clean, catch urine. And if you really want a urine, you have to be prepared to go down to follow it to the natural progression of an invasive urine. So if you're not prepared, you are not worried about this baby enough to do a catheter or an SPA urine, then you should probably not be doing it. So what do we do? Well, it's all about the talk, isn't it? It's all about the reassurance. But what we do have is we do have science on our side. So I like to say to the parents that we know we don't need to do any tests because someone else has already done all the hard work. Someone else's baby already had a blood test they didn't need, so your baby doesn't need to have a blood test they don't need, or something like that. It's not something we've made up. It's actually science. We have science. I think that if you do your examination as thoroughly that, and I call it a driving test examination because I think it's a little bit like when you're doing a driving test, I'm going to have to turn like this because I can't turn my neck, but you know, I'm looking over my shoulder. And I think if you do an overtly almost a dramatic kind of examination of the baby, which is witnessed by the parents. That is vastly reassuring to them. Okay? You need to let them know that there's no quick answers and reassure them that it is normal. In terms of the dietary manipulation and role for meds, etc., there, as David said before, there is some evidence for the use of partially of hydrolyzed formulas, but I think they have a real limited role from the emergency department. I think if you have the family that turn up in desperation, exactly what was discussed before about them having a trial of an over-the-counter product but not providing them with a prescription, because there's no going back from a prescription and the stuff tastes so horrible they won't drink it anyway, and then get organising follow-up. There's no role for commencing PPIs at all in the emergency department or lactose-free formula or anything else. There is a role, however, for organising follow-up, and we should all be aware wherever we work what the community child health centres in our area offer and what is available to these families, and if possible, leave them with some written discharge about when they should seek help. So let's talk about the caregivers. So really, we all knew from the second we walked in that the patients was not the cute little chubby baby, that the real patients here are the caregivers. Now, it's exhausting to have a small infant, being an emergency physician prepares you pretty well because you're pretty used to sleep deprivation, but for lots of people, it's, a massive shock. It's not what they expected whatsoever. And it takes a lot of getting used to for people. Now, it's really important when you take a history from them that you take a really specific history about them as well. What's the function of the family like? Is there any risk factors? If you can, take a mental health history, a drug and alcohol history, a domestic violence history. You might need to separate the parents to do that, or you might need to ask someone else. And if you identify obvious stresses within the family, sometimes it's nice to get someone else in to do that. And lots of departments have social workers that are very happy to come in and take a history from a family and offer support. And if you normalise and you say that this is a very vulnerable time for most people and we've got some social workers that would like to have a chat to you, that will take away the stigma of calling the social worker. The other thing that's really important to do is to take a really good history and be absolutely non-judgmental, so that if there is anything that is of potential risk to the baby, they are likely to confide that into you. So we know that excessive crying is a risk factor for head trauma in infants. And therefore, it's really important to ask the question, how they're going? Do they think they have any issues with a postnatal mood disturbance? How's their mood going? And had they had any thoughts of harming themselves or the baby? Now, postnatal depression is very common. And in one study, they showed that up to 16% of mothers were presenting in the first year to emergency departments for any problem. That's anything from a sore toe to a major life-threatening illness had Edinburgh postnatal depression score of 13. Now, 13 is one that would tick a box to say you need to go and get some follow-up. And we know that people who report excessive crying in babies, if they get to number 9 on the postnatal depression score, they're much more likely to report excessive crying. So postnatal depression is a really important thing to look for. The other thing about postnatal depression is that it actually changes your ability to cope with the crying, in that they've done studies where they looked at women with postnatal depression and found that they were less able to distinguish their infant's cry from another infant's cry or to have an emotional or emotive reaction to that. Interestingly though, if you had musical training as a mum, that ability to differentiate your baby's cry from another baby's cry was maintained even in the presence of postnatal depression. Sorry, as a musician, I found that quite interesting. So, it's all about seeing the light at the tunnel. So you've guided this family through this is now 11:30, you're very tired. You've guided them through this, and it's important that you let them see that they're doing a really good job and that there is light at the end of the tunnel. To finish off Oliver's story, Oliver, you take the history. Mum and Dad are both accountants. Grandma's been there, but she's got to go back to New South Wales next week. They're all very stressed about how everyone's going to cope when she leaves. Baby Oliver's a well-growing baby. He's put 2 kilos on since he's been born. He's been breastfed and bottle-fed top-ups. He does have very smiley days. He tends to have a really good sleep in the morning, usually from 8 o'clock to 11 o'clock he's out like a light, cat naps for the rest of the day. Anyone who's ever had a baby, that's what they do. And then he's usually up, just when the news comes on, he usually starts to wake up, and he's really hard to settle down. They've seen their GP 3 times, he's put them on omeprazole, it hasn't made any difference. That's it. When you examine him, you reassure mum, you reassure grandma. Grandma's very impressed with your examination. She's never seen anybody look in every nook and cranny between every crevice and look at everything, and they're all very reassured. So you've done your job. You've identified that, in fact, he wasn't sick. They were worried and he was panicked. You've reassured them. And as they leave, Dad turns to you, and this is a true story. He says, oh, Doc, he said, before I had a baby, one of the guys at work said, it's 100 days of hell with a newborn, 100 days of hell before they start to get fun. We're halfway there. So what I want you to remember is it's their party, and they'll smile when they want to. Thank you.
Awesome.
Oh, I hit that.
Really good job. Well done. Did you tell she was nervous? She wasn't.
Awesome. I was only nervous because this thing here was called a comfort monitor, which I thought meant it had my notes on it, and then I found out this morning it doesn't, and so I've told them they need to rename it.
Now, as before, if anyone has any questions, start moving towards the microphone now. Don't rush, one at a time. Otherwise, Jess, what have you got?
Cool. I guess grouping into two main themes there. One was just very general appreciation of the subtlety around recognising that parents are likely really, really stressed and not kind of dismissing that and labelling them as atopic. But a flow-on question from that, which was really interesting, is what threshold is there for admitting the baby just to give the parents some respite, I guess?
Yeah, so look, that was in my notes, and if they had been comforting monitors, you might have found out about that.
Well, think of this as your comfort monitor.
So look, I think that it's real, like it needs to take an hour, because I think they'll be back if it doesn't take an hour at least. So yeah. I think this is at the beginning, because they've got all the way to the emergency department and our place paid for parking and all the rest of it, and then they sort of deserve a bit of your time. I think if they don't leave feeling a bit better than when they come in, you have to offer them something. And I think it's better to offer them time than to offer them medicine they don't need. So I usually say to people, look, you know, everything is very reassuring, but if they're still not comfortable to take them home, there's either I say, I think you need to ring your GP and get an appointment now for later in the week to check how you're going, or ring the child health, or here's this number. Or if I think if they're crying, so if I can't stop the mum crying or the dad, you know, everybody crying, or if there are social concerns, which often there are social concerns where there's not a there's discordance in the family about the potential pathology, then I think if you have the facility to do it, then an overnight observation can be really reassuring. But not many places have the facility, and they come with a downside because they, you know, in our place anyway, it's an open short-stay observation ward, and this is a small baby that may or may not have had any immunisations, and so it's not ideal. But I think if you can't... We used to have a nurse at the place I used to work at, and I used to think, if she can't calm them down, I'm admitting them. So if you can't calm them, then I think you have to open your mind to that concept of an admission.
Sure. As a parent that's been admitted to an acute ward, it's not a good place to get a rest.
No, it's not, is it?
It's terrible.
No.
It's like worse than an airport.
Yeah. And I guess the other couple of questions that are really similar was looking at the association between grandparent involvement and parental anxiety.
So I did have a grandparent slide. And look, it's interesting because... It was only a couple of months ago when my mum was up and one of my sons was a bit rude to me, but my mum turned around and said to him, do not talk to my little girl like that. And it really was like a light bulb moment for me that actually grandparents have two sets of family in there. They've got two sets of patients in there. They're worrying about their kids. They're worrying about their kids' kids. I couldn't find any studies looking at whether there was an inverse or not relationship to the number of people. I think our intrinsic thinking the more people are in the room, the less likely there is to be a problem. But I don't think that's never been studied. I think I try to rally with grandparents and try and get them to be practical support if I can. Like, you know, who can do what? Can you stay with them tonight? Can maybe the baby sleep in your room tonight and, you know, mum get some sleep? Yeah.
Yeah, we've got plenty. Any other questions? Just a little bit of time. I was going to ask you, Katie, was there any evidence you saw about the different cultural sort of things that go into this? Because obviously...
I saw all sorts of evidence. So, for instance, French babies cry with an upward inflection.
Right.
German babies cry with a downward inflection. You're much more likely to cry with the inflection and the melody of your mother tongue. It's your mother tongue. It doesn't matter where you were. It's what language your mother speaks.
Right.
That's the most important thing. I think it's really interesting.
There you go.
But in terms of what was the other one, sorry?
Any other, like, so for example, I work with a lot of Aboriginal families. I very rarely see them come in late at night with a normally well child. Like, it just seems to be a grandmother thing that they sorted out in their own sort of household.
Well, I suspect
they just feel alienated from our ED.
Well, I think that would be really hard to tell. What the studies was that parents that were found to have shorter reaction times to their crying, so that if they got up and acted within minutes or, you know, seconds of the baby making noise, they were more likely then to go on to report excessive crying when in fact the time, so it's all about reported time. So the evidence is so difficult to tease out because it's a phenomenon that gets better always by itself. Like it's a net. And so there's a huge observer bias in any of the, and huge, a placebo effect in any intervention in any of this study. But I think some other studies showed that in the first 3 months, so this concept of the fourth trimester, have you heard of the concept of the fourth trimester about sort of close parenting in the first few months of life, but there is some evidence that skin-to-skin contact within the first couple of weeks will decrease perceived crying. I don't know, but it's perceived crying.
Okay. All in the perception.
It is actually all in the perception. Sorry.
Please.
Thanks, Katie. It's Julie McEnower here. I really enjoyed your talk. I really picked up on something you said about the peak time of crying at exactly the same age where there's peak co-sleeping in the parental bed for obvious reasons, and at the same time that there's peak sudden unexpected death in infancy and SIDS. So in that hour, I'm sure there's a great opportunity for some risk minimisation type advice about not co-sleeping, because they'll smile and say yes, but they'll keep doing it, but how to minimise the risk of co-sleeping.
So that's like I always ask about a sleeping arrangement. So I think it's important to present the facts as they are, that we know that co-sleeping within the same bed is a risk factor. There's a lot of those co-sleepers around now, so they're beds where they slide next to your bed. There is some evidence that sleeping in the same room but not in the same bed is a protective factor for SIDS, and it was also a protective factor for the report of infant crying. So bizarrely enough, even though you're closer to them, so you think you could hear them cry, whereas if they're in the next room you might not, their reported infant crying time is less. So I just think it's really important to make sure that you give them the safe sleeping information. And I think it's also important to give people permission to do things like let their babies cry and to tell them what to do. And one of the studies I looked at, which I didn't think I could really talk about here, but I will anyway, was where they looked at a group of people that they identified at risk, and they had given half of them noise-cancelling earplugs. And those people, in terms of happiness scores and postnatal depression scores and other scores, were better off at sort of 6 months, I think it was, than the people that didn't have earplugs. So it's giving people permission. So I actually now say to people, have you got some noise-cancelling headphones? Put on one song. Put the baby in a safe place and put on one song. And I think that's a really important thing to do. Or, you know, we go for a walk out to the garden. Don't leave the property, but go for a walk out to the garden or out to the veranda and leave the baby. So I think it's about giving some practical advice and giving people permission to feel like that's okay.
Turn off the baby monitor.
Don't have a baby monitor.
Any other questions from the floor? Got anything there, Jess? We've got 2 minutes.
nothing
or else,
else
it's an early
nothing
lunch.
Else I did too good a job of synthesizing the collective pool of questions, I think. So
awesome.
There's one here.
Oh.
So that's the other risk factor. So risk factor, the other...
I'll just repeat the question for the video. So do you find that it's the first baby? The first baby, so unexperienced mothers is more...
So primiparity is another big risk factor for the report of infant crying, because I think the second time you get, oh, that's just what they're like, maybe. But yes, yeah, so first baby. So you have to be careful. I have the pleasure of also doing the complaints portfolio in our department, and I've recently had a complaint of a woman who was really insulted that four people in a row asked her if it was a first baby, like it was like we were insinuating that she didn't know what she was doing. But it's really, I think the first babies are, you know, because of all of those other factors, you don't know what to expect. Your reaction times to their sort of normal vocalizations within the first few weeks are probably fairly dramatic. The anxiety's high. So, and even Wessel in 1954 described that first mothers were much more at risk for colicky babies. He actually described it as being, I suppose, the first somatic sort of or medically unexplained symptom. So, you know, the description he says is that paroxysmal fussing, which is his name, may be the earliest sign of physical reaction to stress in the environment.
All right. Well, I think we're going to hit lunch. So if you could just join me in really thanking our wonderful speakers.